If you would, please open your Bibles to Luke chapter 23. Where's Dave White? What's a brother have to do to get a sweet hoodie? I mean, I'm not a young adult. Josh Wentz. Okay, I'll talk to him. Speaking of young adults and staff, if you don't get your stuff from Lost and Found, they're already looking at it. So I'm amazed at how much, I really am. I am amazed how much stuff people leave here. And I don't think these are people who said, I'm not coming back to this church anymore. I think they're you. Hey, by the way, I don't think we announced it last week, but again, Change for Life, this is really important. So if you haven't gotten yourself a baby bottle, get one. Stuff it full of checks and paper money. Not Monopoly money, real paper money. We love to support Crossroads Pregnancy Center, and we'll be receiving them soon and giving them the donations. I'm sure there's something else to say, but why don't we just get into things here? We're going to be looking at history's darkest day today. We're going through Luke, as you know. I mean, I say it all the time, but we're going through Luke on Wednesdays as well as Sundays. So on Wednesdays, we go verse by verse. Sundays, we just take a lump and focus on it. So there's things that, you know, not teaching about today, but you can look at this past Wednesday. You can look at next Wednesday, this coming Wednesday. Come on out as we walk through this. Bless you. Anyway, over the last couple of weeks, we've looked at Judas, we've looked at Peter, we've looked at, you know, what is a betrayal, what is a denial, Jesus in the garden. We spent a lot of time on that on Wednesday night in Garden of Gethsemane, the place of the press, the place of the olive press. That's an interesting study to do on your own sometime, to look at the four pressings of the olives in ancient Israel. And all that you can see in the sacrifice of Christ in the olive press. And so here, the Garden of Gethsemane was his favorite place to go with the guys, where they would pray. I think I mentioned on Wednesday night that those trees that are there, no, the trees themselves, the branches, the leaves, they weren't witnesses to what happened in the garden 2,000 years ago. But the roots of an olive tree really don't die. And so although the Romans and the Turks and all the people who have conquered that part of the world continued to cut the trees down, those roots continue to live. And so I don't like to use this word awesome too much, but, you know, because we use it to describe cheesesteaks and all sorts of things. But it is a pretty awesome experience to spend time in the garden and meditate and to think of the battle that was going on there. The battle that we don't see described, the battle that we don't really spend much time really thinking about, but the hordes of demons and fallen angels that were around Christ as he prayed. The pressure in the spirit that caused that you know, a legitimate medical condition, hematidrosis, but where he would actually ooze out sweat, great drops of blood. And those trees bear a mute witness to what happened there that night. So, of course, Jesus is arrested. Pilate's in the morning, but Judas comes with the Roman guard and the temple guard, and they arrest him. Judas is kissing him, you know, just to make sure they all know this is the guy to arrest. They take him off then to Annas and to Caiaphas in the morning to the Sanhedrin. All of these, an interesting study in themselves, and then Pilate, and then Herod, and then Pilate. And in all these cases where the Romans are concerned, and actually as far as Annas and Caiaphas are concerned, they can't find a legitimate cause to put him to death. The Jews, Annas, Caiaphas, the Sanhedrin, they want him dead. But we even read in Mark that the witnesses that they line up, false witnesses, they couldn't even get their story straight. Pilate says, I find no fault in the man. Over and over, he says this. He finds out that Jesus is a Galilean. You know, if you're in the corporate world, you understand buck passing. Sends him off to Herod. Herod just wants entertainment, but he can't find anything to bring a charge against Jesus. Sends him back to Pilate, back and forth, back and forth. I know you know the story. And And of course, the crowd of Jews outside, I believe, it's only my opinion, but I believe that we make a mistake. We often hear it preached, I think I've done it myself, that the same crowd that 4 days earlier was praising him during the triumphal entry is there now saying, crucify him. I don't think so. That's just my opinion. I think this is a setup team. And the leaders of Israel, the Sanhedrin, you know, these guys, they're juicing the crowd. Crucify him, crucify him. There were three, and we all know this. I mean, there might be a person in here who's never heard the story before, but we all know the story. There are three who were condemned to go to that cross. These two, who we see later, and this one, Barabbas, Bar Abba, son of the father. It's an interesting pun that's going on here. And he was already convicted. He was an insurrectionist, the real kind, not the kind, you know. Just saying, it's amazing that in this day and age you actually have to define these things, right? He's convicted because he was an insurrectionist. He was trying to overthrow Rome. And he was a murderer, so legitimately, he should be put to death. At least the Romans had a couple things right back in those days. But the crowd wanted Jesus crucified. And I know I've said this before, but I often think of Barabbas chained. I mean, you have to really, it's hard to talk about it. You have to sort of visualize it for yourself. You're convicted. You're not getting a lethal injection. They're not just going to take off your head. They're going to nail you to a cross. And every fiber of your being will be screaming in a way you've never screamed before. And you, the fear, I can't imagine, that must go through a person knowing that that's what they're facing. And Barabbas knows that. And he's in a dungeon. He's downstairs in a dungeon, and he hears the crowd roaring outside. He doesn't hear what Pilate's saying. Pilate's saying about Jesus, I find no fault in the man. You know, but there's a tradition, and I'm happy to release Jesus to you, you know, and I'll put Barabbas to death. And they're saying, no, give us Barabbas. But they're yelling, Barabbas, Barabbas. And he's saying, what do I do with your king, this Jesus? Crucify him. Barabbas is hearing, Barabbas, crucify him. Barabbas. So the Romans hate him. The crowds want him dead. He knows it's just a question of a short amount of time before he's history. But of course, and how would you feel if after all of that, the guard comes and unshackles you? And you're like, okay, here we go. And he says, go. Where? You're free. Free. And he walks out. And here's Jesus, who's already been beaten up. He's not scourged yet, but he's beaten up. And you look at him on your way out, knowing that somehow, no, that you're free, but this man is going to take your place. And of course, then, the scourging happens. It's hard for us to understand scourging, and I know that it's mourning and some people get icky, but if I don't tell you what it's about, I'm not doing the job. Scourging, think about the people who have the job. Roman soldiers, they're assigned for 25 years, and they're given a particular assignment. So now you're dealing with men who, you know, they've seen war, and they're trained. But these guys are trained to be torturers. They're trained to be executioners. Before they really scourge them, and after they've beaten them up, that's when they're putting the robe on them. They're putting the crown of thorns on his head. And some of you know, especially if you've been to Jerusalem, and we've been in the Antonia Fortress, there was that game they played, the game of the king, or kill the king. These Roman soldiers, they hated the emperor. The emperor had everything. They got salt as a salary. That's where we get the word salary from. They hated the king. So kill the king was basically a board game, and the floor of the Antonia Fortress was the game board, and they would roll dice, and they would take this condemned prisoner with a purple robe like the emperor and a crown of thorns. They didn't just do it for Jesus. They did it for anyone. They didn't care. They're equal opportunity executioners. And they would roll dice, and it would determine which steps the condemned man would take. And the instructions are right there on the pavement. Some of you have seen it. And there was one place on the game board where if the condemned prisoner got there, you can see the dagger engraved, and they would just run him through before he ever went out to the cross. I suspect what happened here, it's only a suspicion, that the word came down that, okay, bring him out. So they didn't get a chance to execute him. These are trained torturers. This is sport for them. And he's brought to the scourging, where he's stripped and he's tied over a beam and he's flogged, not with 39 lashes. That's a Jewish tradition. These are Romans. They have no such traditions. And their job is to continue to flog the prisoner, the condemned man, until he gives in, until he gives names of who he was involved with. They lay it on harder and harder. It's not a whip. It's 9 leather straps with lead balls, shells, glass, things like that. And this man is trained to flay the back and to strip him down, strip his skin off down to the bone, exposing the organs. It was not uncommon for a condemned man to die at the scourging before he ever went to the cross. And of course, he laid it on harder and harder because Jesus said nothing. Jesus didn't give your name or my name. He was taking your place at that point. Isaiah 52, that his visage was so marred beyond that of any man. In fact, Isaiah says something. He said, and we hid our faces from him. What does that mean? Well, it means, you know what it's like. We don't talk about it very much, but you know, maybe you're out on the street somewhere and you see someone who's really disfigured, and there's a part of you that really wants to look and another part of you that knows you shouldn't be. That's what he's talking about. His visage was so marred beyond that of any man that we hid our faces from him. Finally, he's brought to Pilate. The soldiers must tell him he didn't give any names. And here he is. He doesn't even look like a man in a sense anymore. And Pilate says, Ecce homo, behold the man. And they say, crucify him. And I have to believe Pilate is so wigged out by this whole situation. He doesn't want to condemn him. He doesn't want to put him to the cross, but the Jewish leadership wants to do that. He said, should I crucify your king? Crucify him, crucify him. He's had multiple interactions with Jesus by now. He's looked in Jesus' eyes, but the weird part is that Jesus looked into his. In fact, Jesus looked beyond his eyes into his soul, and that really creeped him out. And then his wife says to him, don't have anything to do with this man. I've had a dream. Don't even deal with him. Get rid of him as much as you can. He doesn't know. He's trapped. Above anything else, Pilate's a political animal. That's a separate study in itself. He has to do something. And his biggest concern is that if this gets back to Rome, that I let a man free who claimed to be the king of Israel and wanted to overturn Rome, what's going to happen to me? And so he brings out a basin of water and he washes his hands in public. And he says, I wash my hands of the whole situation. And of course, the people yell, let his blood be upon us and also upon our children. And then they lead him out. They lead him out to the cross. And on the way, of course, and by the way, we read about Jesus, but it's Jesus and these two others. We read about one of them called One, and the other is called The Other. Those are the only names we have, One and The Other, who are a very interesting study in themselves. And he's let out, you know the story about Simon of Cyrene, Jesus falling under, imagine how much blood he's lost, how spent he is, carrying this cross beam, like think of a railroad tie, maybe 100 pounds. 100 pounds is something to carry in the first place, let alone when you're already that worn. He falls flat on his face because that's what the Romans did. They'd put a leather strap around his ankle, yank it while he was walking. Bam, flat on his face. Get up! They're kicking him, all this, and finally they take the crossbeam and they lay it on this other man, Simon from Tripoli, Cyrene. And I don't know this because it doesn't say it here, but I wonder, I think it's in Jesus' character, that he must have looked right at Simon and said, "Thank you, Simon." And so let's pick up in verse 32. There were also two other criminals led with him to be put to death. And when they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right and the other on the left. See, one and the other. Then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." In the Greek, the idea is he continued to say this. So he didn't say it once. Did he say it three times, five, eight? I don't know. But it got people's attention. "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do." And they divided his garments. They cast lots. And the people stood looking on, but even the rulers with them sneered, saying, "He saved others." Isn't that interesting? They know that. "He saved others. Let him save himself, if he is, in fact, the Christ, the chosen of God." And the soldiers also mocked him, coming and offering sour wine and saying, "If you are the king of the Jews, then save yourself." And an inscription also was written over him in the letters Greek, Latin, in Hebrew, saying, "This is the King of the Jews." Then one of the criminals who were hanged blasphemed him. By the way, Matthew tells us that both of them were reviling him. Both of these criminals were doing it. Luke's the only one who gives us this story. One of them who was hanged blasphemed him, saying, "If you are the Messiah, then save yourself and us." But the other, say, so in heaven, you'll see the other and say, "Tell me your name, because I've been calling you the other for all these years." But the other, answering, rebuked him and said, "Don't you even fear God, seeing that you are under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." And then he said to Jesus, "Lord, Kurios," like we would say, "Jehovah." Not just Master, Lord, Lord God, "remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus said, "Wait a minute, weren't you the guy who was just reviling me? Who are you to say?" No, he said, "Assuredly, I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise." Now it was about the sixth hour, this would be by noon, so he's put on the cross at 9, now it's noon. And there was darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour, 3 p.m. And when the sun was darkened, and the veil of the temple was torn in two. And when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And having said this, he breathed his last. So when the centurion, the one in charge of the scene, when he saw what had happened, he glorified God, saying, "Certainly this was a righteous man." And the whole crowd who came together to that sight, seeing what had been done, they beat their breasts and they returned. But all his acquaintances and the women who followed him from Galilee stood at a distance, watching these things. Well, there's a lot here, quite obviously. And if you have read the other gospel accounts, you realize Luke doesn't report on some things that the others do. He also gives us some information that the others do not. Jesus is led to the cross, and he's crucified there. He's crucified. He's not tied with ropes to the crossbeam like we see in the movies. The Roman accounts, you can read some of these online if you look for them, the Roman accounts of crucifixion are quite interesting. By the way, the shortest crucifixion on record, the shortest one, 35 hours. See, we have 6 hours that happens here. It's for religious reasons that they came and broke the legs of these other criminals, and they find that Jesus had already given up the ghost. He was already dead by then. So we get this idea that it happens quickly. The shortest one on record, 35 hours. The longest one that I've found is 9 days. We just sang on a hill far away. Well, that's a hill far away from here. But if you were in Jerusalem, it's not up on a mountaintop you can't reach. The Romans would crucify a condemned man or woman at eye level. Their intention was that you would look into the eyes of this tortured, condemned man, and you would be taught a simple lesson. You don't want to mess with Rome. They would take the hands and drive a spike in at the medial nerve to create the most possible pain on both sides. Hey, I can do that. PT has worked, right? how about that? And then they would also, once the arms were done, the hands were done, then they would put the left leg down, the right one, right foot on top of it, and drive a spike in through the metatarsal, down through both feet into, how's that feel to you? You're not paying attention then. The Roman accounts are very clear. You do that to a, I mean, how would you be responding? Would you be like, well, okay, here we go? I don't think so. No, people are fighting, they're cursing, they're, first of all, they're condemned criminals for the most part, right? But they're fighting, they're cursing, they're writhing, they're doing everything possible to get away from that, but you have trained torturers, pretty strong dudes, who are just holding you down, and they're going to drive those spikes through your wrists and through your feet. I can't imagine how horrifying this was, just to watch, just to listen to, let alone to be that person. And they crucified them. We're not told which order they did it in. But he was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearer is silent, he opened not his mouth. The others were writhing and wrestling and swearing. They were doing everything possible to just fight. I mean, but he opened not his mouth. And they, remember, they carried the crossbeam. But when they got to the place of crucifixion, that crossbeam was attached with a peg into the upright, which was laying on the ground. And then once they were pinned there, then with ropes they would pull the whole contraption, the whole cross, upright. Thunk! Into the ground. Imagine. Are you feeling it yet? I want you to. Not because I want to torture you, but because we've allowed Hollywood to sanitize this for us, and we have a sanitary view of things. And there's nothing wrong with cross jewelry and things like that, but we often wear this means of execution around our neck or wherever it is. It's fine. But we forget what it really means. And so he's crucified there. And yet, While the others are flailing and wrestling and swearing, when they come to Jesus and they spike him to the crossbeam and to the upright, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. If you were a trained torturer, would this get your attention? You're used to men fighting. You like it when they fight because you can fight back and you're stronger. You're going to win. You have the entire power of Rome and authority of Rome behind you. And Jesus doesn't do that. And again, the sense is he says this over and over. I suggest that means while he's on the cross, upright, three crosses. Three criminals on the cross. Wait, Hessler, that's not right. Two criminals and Jesus. No, three criminals. First of all, he took Barabbas' place. But he who knew no sin, Paul says, 2 Corinthians 5, he who knew no sin became sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God. He became me on that cross. If you know Christ as your Savior, he became you on that cross. Three criminals on this cross. But what a picture, looking at the two, the one and the other. Because the one and the other are a perfect picture of all of mankind. They're a perfect picture of all of mankind. If you think about it, even from all the way back, Cain and Abel. Cain thinks he can work his way to please God. Abel brings blood sacrifice. It's always about God's standard is always substitutionary atonement. From Cain and Abel flow all of world's religions. Good works or substitutionary atonement. It's always that. That's the story of Cain and Abel. And you can trace this down throughout all of history. It's such a picture. It's such a picture of humanity. The one, they're both reviling. The one continues and the other says, what are you doing? Don't you see we're both condemned for just reasons, for just cause? We call them thieves on the cross. Rome did not execute, did not crucify men for robbery. So they probably were thieves, but that's not what got them to the cross. Insurrection, murder, things like that. Those are the things that put a person on the cross. Now, how Rome defined that, I think, was pretty loose. But nevertheless, in fact, I might have mentioned this Wednesday night, sorry. But there are accounts of miles and miles of crucifixes back in the day. You know, we tend to see three crosses on a hill. No, it was a big deal for Rome. That's how they tried to keep control over society. Two men, the one and the other. What is it? What is it that caused the other to change? He's somebody's prodigal. What is it that caused him to change? I don't know. You know, Luke does not tell us what the others tell us. Luke doesn't tell us that at this point, at some point in this, while it was still light, and while Jesus is suffering. Now, remember, he doesn't even look like a man. He's a, pardon the expression, but he's a bloody piece of meat. And I don't know what you think he sounded like, but I got a feeling he didn't sound the way you and I think he sounded. Remember later on when he says, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani? They're like, he's calling Elijah. Why did they think that? Because he couldn't speak. You know, that's when he said, I thirst. His tongue, in fact, David writes it in Psalm 22, my tongue cleaves to my jaw. You know, so what do you think he's, you know what it's like when you're just thirsty. Just regular thirsty. What did he sound like? But he says to John, and he says to Mary, he says, son, behold your mother. Woman, behold your son. I mean, the soldiers and these men on the cross, they're observing all of this. This is not a time. The cross, that place of crucifixion is not the place where people are doing things like that. It's just not happening. We have to get this out of our mind. We've read the Bible account so many times. We think, this stuff happens. No, it doesn't. It doesn't happen. This is a horrifying place, and horrifying things happen in this place. He takes care of his mother. He sets things up for her with John. And this man will say, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. He didn't know the four spiritual laws. He didn't know the sinner's prayer. He's not been baptized. He wasn't christened when he was a little child. All of these things that we associate with being right with God, what religion tells us makes us right with God, not at all. Jesus doesn't say, look, talk to my mom. He doesn't do anything like that. You haven't had your first Holy Communion yet. None of these things are being said. They're not going through his mind because they're not relevant. Man has invented these things. And this man, when he says, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he remembers something from growing up. He remembers something about the Torah and all this, the kingdom, the future. Someday, the kingdom. Assuredly, I tell you, today, you'll be with me in paradise. Today, in paradise. Now, you've read it so many times, this makes no impression on us. It's sad what's happened to us because we've read it so much. And it's good to read it. Try to see it afresh today. I tell you the truth. You and me in paradise. And Jesus is the first to die out of that three. You know, jumping ahead, the Jewish leaders come to Pilate and say, look, this is the holiest day that's coming. This is the evening of the holiest day. We can't have these guys up on the cross. So Pilate's like, hey. This Gentile from Rome is like now saying, oy vey. And so he says, look, take care of them. And that's why the soldiers come to break the legs. I didn't tell you this. Some of you do know, but many of us don't. So crucifixion isn't just spiking a person. It was designed to inflict the greatest amount, the maximum amount of torture, while extending the life as long as possible. That was the whole point of it. And so what they would do is, you know, with the upright, they would put a little bit, because the Romans were showing how merciful they were, they put a little shelf that you could sit on. It was about 4 inches wide. And, you know, you're suspended on this cross. You're slumping down, but when you did that, your diaphragm was affected. You couldn't breathe. You must do, of all the things we think we must do in our lives, you must live. You must breathe in order to live. And so the only way to do that is to push up against that spike in your metatarsals. Hasn't affected you yet. I can just see on your faces. Not that I expect you to weep. But I think sometimes we don't think about it because it happened to somebody else. You push up against the spike that's driven through your metatarsal to gasp. Try to get up on that ledge, but you slump down again. And that's hours, days, perhaps. And so when Pilate orders the soldiers to break the legs, the whole point is break their legs, you can't breathe. You can't push up, you're dead. Jesus, of course, has already died. He gave up the ghost. Why? I'm getting ahead of myself. But Luke only tells us certain things. He doesn't tell us some other things. He doesn't tell us when he says that when Jesus, verse 46, had cried out with a loud voice, then he said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. What he cried out with a loud voice, and this is at the end of all that time, it is finished. By the way, Isaiah says that he will make his soul, I'm just here to report. I can't explain certain things. He'll make his soul an offering for sin. Make his soul an offering for sin. Think about that. His body's still alive. When he says it is finished, his body's still alive. Where has he been during those 3 hours of darkness? The first 3 hours, the sun is shining. Oh, he's being tortured. But he's not reviling anyone. He's saying, Father, over and over. And those soldiers down below him, gambling for his garments. Do you think they're hearing him saying, Father, forgive them? They don't know what they're doing. They've got to hear some of that. We know the centurion did. And imagine what it was like when suddenly at noon, darkness. People have tried to explain it. I read one guy who said it was a sandstorm. And there are sandstorms that will come to Israel once in a while. And this is not a sandstorm. And for many years, and many of us were sort of raised being taught this, that this was an eclipse. Well, number one, if it was an eclipse, it wouldn't be pitch black. But it can't be an eclipse because this is Passover. That's a full moon. And you can't have a solar eclipse during a full moon. You may not have known that, but that's the truth. So it's not that. God shut off the sun. And it wasn't dark. It was black. Like it wasn't Egypt. It was black. It was pure, cold, evil, black. Imagine the birds would have gone silent. And imagine the confusion among all the people. It's not like the streetlights automatically come on. There's no electricity. No one knows what to do. It's absolute madness. And this one who had just said, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." He says, "Surely I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise." And then it goes black. I mean, what's happening? You've never seen anything like this before. And now you hear, my God, why have you forsaken me? What have you just done if you're the other? You know, what's happening there? Let me read it to you. Here's a piece of it. David says this, I recommend if you've never read this, it's good to go back and read it. Psalm 22, David writes this a thousand years before Christ. A thousand years before Christ. It's at minimum 700 years before crucifixion was invented, okay? Before it was invented. I can't read the whole thing, but let me just read some of it. It starts out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me and from the words of my groaning? Oh, my God, I cry in the daytime, but you don't hear. In the night seasons, I cry, and I'm not silent. I'm a worm. I'm no man. I'm a reproach of men. I'm despised by the people. Those who see me ridicule me. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head, saying, he trusted in the Lord. Let him rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. What's David thinking? What is David's experience that he would write this? And yet what he's writing is a full prophecy of what we're reading on that cross, about on that cross. Don't be far from me. Trouble is near, for there's none to help. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have circled me. They gape at me with their mouths like a raging and a roaring lion. What's that about? Well, I would say these are the fallen angels who gave rise to the Nephilim in before the flood, and to the Nephilim and the giants after the flood. You read about them in Numbers and Deuteronomy. That's what he's talking about here. It's wickedness. These strong bulls that are like a raging lion, these are fallen angels. I'm poured out like water. My bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue clings to my jaws. You've brought me to the dust of death, for dogs have surrounded me. The congregation of the wicked has enclosed me. They've pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look and stare at me. They divide my garments among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots. I don't think the Romans were trying to do this to fulfill some prophecy. Right? My God, why have you forsaken me? Why does he cry that? He had just cried, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And his last words, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. But here in the middle, my God, and a word you don't hear from Jesus. Why? Why? Luther was the one who said, you know, this is God forsaken of God. How? I don't know how. I just talk. But how? Out of the Godhead is one person of the Godhead carved out suddenly from the Father and the Spirit, that he would say, my God, why? Cut off because he's now, his soul is offered as an offering for sin, for you, for me. Yeah, there's a lot that goes on here. And in the midst of all this, in the midst of this darkness, as we get toward the end of it, in those 3 hours of darkness, while somehow, in a way we were not really told, business is being done for me, for you. Business is being done here for you and for me. And then an earthquake, an enormous earthquake. Josephus talks about it. He says that 40 years before the destruction of the temple, there was this great earthquake, and it caused this problem in the temple. Imagine, this is the time of the evening sacrifices. It's 3 in the afternoon. The priests are getting ready to do the work, but this darkness has come over. So I have to believe that Well, it confused them, if nothing else. Maybe it stopped the whole thing. But then the veil. What is the veil? Let's keep it in mind. It's 60 feet high. It's 10 feet wide. And it's woven linen, but they describe it as a hand breadth, so I guess it depends on the hand. So that's 8 to 10 inches thick. Could two cars pull that apart? I don't know. But it also, Matthew says, from the top to the bottom. So these weren't priests who were cutting it, okay? From the top to the bottom, God pulled it apart, saying, open for business now. Because my son has made offering for sin. No more will the blood of bulls and goats be required. Because sacrifice has been made. Works don't do it. Don't try to mend the veil anymore. By the way, yeah, I don't know what you think about this guy on the cross. But people often say, you know, the guy on the cross, I love the guy on the cross. I do, I love the guy on the cross. I love the guy on the cross because it tells me there's always that last chance that everyone has. It's true. But listen, how many times do you read about this kind of a conversion in the Bible? A deathbed conversion. How many times? One? Five? Ten? What do you think? Once. So don't presume. You know, that I like the way Spurgeon says it as he preached about it. He said, you know, on the day when rewards are given, you know, that this guy will come and say to the Lord, look, I'm just going to keep walking. I got in at the last minute. And the Lord's going to say, no, hold on. Let me show you the millions of prisoners who have come to Christ because of your testimony. Let me tell you about all the deathbed conversions that have happened because of you. Imagine this one, the first one to see Jesus when he dies. And I have to believe that one nail-scarred hand grabs the other nail-scarred hand and says, come on in. Father, here's the first one. When all is said and done, and there's a lot to look at here, this is all we can do today. The centurion sees everything that happens. And I didn't even get to Matthew 27 where he says the graves were open and saints from old started walking around. No one preaches about that stuff. But the centurion here, he says, surely this was a righteous man. Over in Matthew, he says, surely this was the Son of God. Yeah. He was, and he is, the Son of God. There's so much for us in all of this. There's so much for us in all of this.